And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson. You've tuned in right here, week 11. This is a time that we circled on the calendar way back in, June, July, the SEC, they released their schedule like 8 years ago. But it is my pleasure to welcome, with this big, big Thursday and Saturday ahead, Dan Rubenstein, SB Nation, the Solid Verbal Podcast. Dan, I was honored to be a guest on your podcast. It is my pleasure to bring you here to the Eye on College Football.
It is my pleasure to be on the Eye on Football. It's been too long.
Dan, you have your finger on the pulse. I've always been very impressed by your knowledge of West Coast football in general, but also you kind of know the Ducks a little bit, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Yes,
a little bit,
and that was one of the reasons why it came to mind. And want to start before we dive into Oregon and Stanford. I'd like to think our listeners are also like us, passionate college football viewers, and with Oregon and Stanford offset by an hour and a half of Oklahoma at Baylor, let's sort of get some general viewing things out of the way. Dan,
sure.
Which do you think will be, in the end, a closer game between Baylor-Oklahoma and Oregon-Stanford?
I think Oregon-Stanford probably, just because those two teams both seem like they're just more complete teams, both of those squads, whereas Oklahoma and Baylor feels like a more likely blowout. If that game's going to blow out, it's going to be Baylor over Oklahoma. I don't think Oklahoma has the ability. Oklahoma has the ability to make it sloppy and lower scoring than Baylor would like it to be. But in terms of a closer, well-fought game, I feel like Oregon and Stanford can do many more things well than both Baylor and Oklahoma.
So where do you expect the point explosions to come from? You think that's just going to be Baylor eventually? Because I could see Oklahoma making it ugly the way that Stanford probably wants to make it ugly. But I could also see there being that moment in the third quarter where things get out of hand real quickly in Waco.
Yeah, I could see that as well. And I'm not fully sold. There's a lot of talent on Oklahoma's defense, but certainly they're more beat up than they were a few weeks ago, especially with Corey Nelson out for the year with his injury. I'm not fully sold on Oklahoma and their ability to stop a team for four quarters, especially given their schedule. And they don't make the schedule, but when you look at what Texas was able to do and you look at their big, shining, crowning achievement on defense, came against Tommy Rees and a Notre Dame team that is, they've certainly taken a large step back from where they were last season. I'm not sure that I buy Oklahoma's ability to run with Baylor, to run with Tevin Rees, to for four quarters stop Lake Seastruck and Shaq Linwood and those guys. Whereas with Stanford, especially on defense, even though they have their own injuries on the defensive side of the ball, that secondary is so good, the linebackers are so good, and the ability to tackle sideline to sideline is so good, where I feel like Stanford has more of an opportunity, especially given their defensive track record against Oregon last season, to really limit things. I think you could see Baylor go up big early. That, to me, is not an unlikely scenario.
Yeah. Because that's almost Baylor. I mean, as far as offensive prowess goes, Baylor entering the Oklahoma game, not dissimilar from where Oregon was operating even 10 games into their schedule before they ran into Stanford last year.
Right.
What do you feel more confident based on this particular version of the Ducks offense now that we've got Scott Frost in as offensive coordinator and sort of the whole shifting and the evolution, which also, I mean, as you and I probably have both said many times, has a lot to do with the quarterback as well.
Yes, absolutely. I'm more confident in Oregon's offense this year, maybe outside of the running back position, but the running back position may have more speed than it ever has, which it's always weird for me, and this is the most arrogant, awful thing I can say as an Oregon fan. Always weird for me to see when running backs for other teams get caught from behind. Always very strange. But in terms of Oregon's offense this year, the offensive line is better. The quarterback is better. The quarterback play is better than it was last season. The receiver position is a lot better with the emergence of Braylon Addison and Josh Huff needing to be accounted for in every play and in sort of multiple ways. They move them around a lot. But the tight end position, I don't think, is as versatile because Colt Lyerla could do so much both in the run game and the pass game, both blocking and running the ball himself, weirdly enough, as a tight end. But the fill-ins in Farrell Brown and Johnny Munt, sort of approach his athleticism and versatility to the point where I'm not super worried about it. You saw what Johnny Munt was able to do against Tennessee in his first ever start. So not really worried about the offense. Mark Helfrich has a very good understanding of how to be dominant. Scott Frost has been very good. It's weird to me to see how much the Oregon offense has passed the ball in first halves of games. And I've been somewhat vocal about that. And, you know, Marcus Mariota hasn't thrown a pick, and, you know, who am I to complain about it?
Right.
But it is interesting to see the evolution of that, specifically because Oregon was not able to pass the ball with a ton of success against the Stanford defense last season to set up the run. And that's been sort of the MO this season. So that to me is a big storyline going into the offense-defense matchup in this game.
A lot of pressure on Byron Marshall, who's played well recently, which
yes.
is a good sign for the Ducks.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's an interesting case because he's fast and he's very aggressive. He had some turnover issues early on. My big complaint with these running backs, and it's really a nothing complaint, is Oregon was spoiled with LaMichael James and to a slightly lesser extent Kenyon Barner in that they were smaller but really were warriors between the tackles. And you don't see that as much. The yards after contact are not as good, whereas LaMichael James really stuck his nose in. And still I don't feel like he got the credit that was deserved as for running between the tackles and as a power runner. And with Byron Marshall looking fantastic, mind you, and Thomas Tyner, the freshman, and hopefully a less hobbled DeAnthony Thomas this week, you'll see sort of a variety of different types of running.
DeAnthony Thomas's mouth isn't broken. We saw that on Monday. Let me pitch this to you. I think one of the big reasons why this Oregon defense seems to be, I mean, we're top 20 in third down defense, top 20 in rushing defense allowed in the country. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Taylor Hart, Eric Armstead, and Tony Washington. I think the defensive line, and maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention because I was so wowed and entranced by the offense before.
Right.
But, man, I feel like this defensive line is the best that Oregon's had in these last couple years.
This is the best defense that Oregon's probably ever had. And this is something that offensive players
wow.
who've been there for a while. Yeah, the big difference is, one, the secondary is so experienced that they can be trusted on islands. They do miss, I mean, they clearly miss just because he's so good and showing it at the next level, Kiko Alonso and also Michael Clay at the linebacker positions. But what Oregon is doing for the first time really ever, and it really points to an SEC mentality, is they're putting a lot of their best athletes on defense. And that's something that was never true of Mike Bellotti teams. And they were successful, but you're looking at guys playing linebacker that were, you know, all-state running backs. You're looking at, like, Derek Malone. You're looking at safeties, Avery Patterson. All of these guys were big-time offensive players in high school that offensive coaches wanted at Oregon, and Oregon has built up depth. And you mentioned the defensive line. That D-line is as deep as it's ever been. DeForest Buckner. You got a bunch of guys that are, like, 6'6", 6'7", just enormous athletic dudes. Yeah, DeForest Buckner, I think, was Mr. Hawaii basketball, and now he's playing like drop end and defensive end for the Oregon football team. So there's all sorts of crazy athleticism on this defense that didn't exist before.
All right, so Stanford, first of all, on the defensive side of the ball, Derek Mason done a pretty good job. They're a little bit banged up in the secondary. Mm-hmm. Ed Reynolds is now back. Now they're banged up along the defensive front. They get Henry Anderson back, Ben Gardner out. I think that when we've seen Stanford at their best, they've been able to get to the quarterback. That seems like a really bad matchup with the way the Oregon's offense is going. Is it just that sideline-to-sideline speed and just sort of smarts and just having the key to understanding how to slow this down? Because last year, it felt like a total team sort of slow the game down because they were doing such a good job of holding Oregon on third down, but also sort of ball control on offense. And ball control on offense hasn't always been a particular strength for this team and one that really bit them in that Utah loss.
Right. You know, all fair points. Yeah, defensively, Stanford is built to do what a lot of teams would like to do. And to solve the Oregon offense, it's not a complicated thing. It's taking the right angles. It's defeating blocks and sideline to sideline stuff. It's basically just tackling in the open field. And not a lot of teams, you can be as fundamentally sound as you'd like to be as a football team, but you can't really fundamental speed. So if Oregon is just running by people, it doesn't matter how sound of a tackler you are. Whereas Stanford has really improved under both Jim Harbaugh and David Shaw is getting players in the right position and upping the athletic level, the talent level of those guys and putting them. We saw Richard Sherman, for example, a few years ago, move from wide receiver to cornerback. So they're doing a lot of that, and they're winning those tackles with screens, with short passes. That's where Oregon really tends to kill people, is you get a little bit of space, and Oregon wins with speed, with moves. And Stanford has been fundamentally sound and has made open field tackles. And we've seen a number of teams struggle with tackling against Oregon. It's just the talent level isn't there. And finally, with Stanford and getting the guys like you mentioned, some of whom are hurt, some of whom aren't. Trent Murphy is ridiculous in this. Yeah. That they've just been so sound, and it's Derek Mason, and it's these players creating turnovers, getting to the quarterback, and it really it has been weird to see, just because of how successful they've been on offense these past few years, that the offense is really kind of holding Stanford back. They don't have the playmakers that they once did at tight end, at quarterback, and the depth of running back isn't what it was.
So you've been I am a listener. I am a listener of the Solid Verbal Podcast, and you have been pretty hot with your against the spread picks.
Yes, I have. Somehow.
But you also get to choose yours. So would you be would you be picking this game against the spread as one of your three picks this week?
Yes, I will. Well, we'll be picking a bunch of the big games on the Solid Verbal itself. I don't know what my record is overall on that, but on Easy Call on SB Nation, this is one of the games I'm picking, and I'm well over 500 on that. I think I'm 30-18-2, I want to say. So yes, that's on Easy Call. On the Solid Verbal, we'll be picking this game against the spread with a number of other games. We don't shy away from the big games.
Well, okay. So what do you think? You've got the Ducks to cover 10, or are you taking Stanford to cover and Ducks to win? Because it sounds like you feel pretty confident Oregon's going to win this game. I am. I think Oregon's going to win this game.
I'm pretty confident. The line hasn't shifted any dramatic way, which makes me feel like Vegas probably has it about right for gamblers to pick this game pretty evenly. I think it's going to be relatively close. I don't think Stanford has the ability, if Oregon gets rolling, which I think, because they do get healthier a little bit on offense with the Anthony Thomas, if Oregon gets rolling at all, I have my doubts about Stanford's ability to keep up. This Oregon defense, which is largely the same as it was last year, a little bit healthier actually, shut down the Stanford offense, a much better Stanford offense with Zach Ertz. This is a Stanford team that scored
Taylor.
Right. The Zach Ertz touchdown was an amazing play in the back of the end zone. That was one of the plays that was needed to get behind this Oregon defense. This Stanford offense isn't better than what it was last season. So it is at Stanford. It is a big game. Kevin Hogan wins games, but he's looked pretty sloppy of note. And if Oregon's able to stop Tyler Gaffney to a reasonable degree, I don't know how Stanford wins this game. It's a beat-up Devin Kajust, who appears to be their biggest tight end weapon. Ty Montgomery has been somewhat inconsistent in the receiving game. It's going to take multiple huge special teams plays from Ty Montgomery, which they did need against what we're seeing is a so-so Washington team. I think Oregon has too many ways at this point, with how deep their defense finally is and how explosive I think we imagine their offense will become over the course of four quarters. I think Oregon probably wins this game. I'm going to say the spread's about 10.5.
Yeah, 10.5. I think it might have opened at, 11 or so? Yeah, you're right. I don't think it's moved much.
Right. So they scored about 50 for a couple of years in a row once at Stanford. I'm going to say Oregon wins this game 37-20.
Is there any other game besides this, after Stanford, Utah, Arizona, then Oregon State, that game being in Eugene?
Right.
None of them, you don't think the Ducks get tripped up anywhere there along the way?
The Arizona game is a little bit tricky, just because they may have the best running back in the country in Kadeem Carey, and if he's able to get loose a little bit, we saw Washington keep it close behind a top-flight running back in Bishop Sankey. I'm just not a big believer in the Arizona defense. Utah could be interesting if it were at Utah. I think if they get by Stanford, though, especially with how Oregon State has responded or sort of not responded against teams not terrible in the Pac-12, it's hard for me to imagine Oregon slipping up with so much experience all over the field, being in big spots, playing in these big games. But yeah, at Stanford is the challenge. But I really can't envision a scenario. Utah playing on the road is not the same team. Arizona's defense and Oregon State just not a defensive enough team to make a mark against Oregon. It's tough.
I think that Oregon will benefit eventually from a UCLA schedule. Well, UCLA having all the injuries, but a UCLA schedule that might not even put them in that Pac-12 title game, as they still have to play at Arizona, Washington, Arizona State, and then at USC. And depending on the health of UCLA and how well they're playing, you know, that could be a dangerous – the Bruins might lose 2 to 3 of those games down the stretch.
Yeah, no, it's entirely possible, and you should remember that UCLA has only lost to top five teams, essentially,
right,
with Stanford and Oregon. So, you know, Brett Hundley looked a lot better against, granted, Colorado. UCLA, what they do on defense is better than what any other team that they play for the rest of the schedule does. I'm not a huge believer in Arizona State, but they are legitimately good. And USC's defense is impressive, but they're a more complete team, I still feel like, at this point, than the rest of their schedule. I just hate what they do schematically on offense so much that I can't fully invest in this Bruin team. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Arizona State's playing the best. USC's defense is looking terrific. I would still say that UCLA's ceiling is higher than the rest of these teams in the South.
You don't like all those swing passes?
I hate the Noel Mazzoni swing pass. Especially Brett Hundley throws such a pretty ball downfield.
I know.
He's accurate, he's fast, and then just swinging it to running backs and scat backs that are just sort of so-so is just so disheartening, especially against teams like Oregon and Stanford, which have proven that you can, A, throw the ball a little bit downfield on them, and B, are really sound tackling in space. And if you're counting on UCLA running backs and slot receivers, which are just okay to make plays, it breaks my heart.
Trying to make the swing cool like Brian Setzer. That's the UCLA Bruins.
I like that.
All right, so I feel pretty confident about Baylor as well. This Oklahoma team, they've been up, they've been down, they've been hard to figure out. And I would say the same thing about, I don't know, the entire Big 12. I have struggled to figure out, because of the inconsistencies, who is going to rise up and potentially be that challenger, because in the Big 12, of course, you have the round robin. So going undefeated through that schedule is very, very impressive. And that is something that I think, as we get, you know, closer to the end of the season, if Baylor is able to continue this run, you know, that's something that's absolutely going to come up. But Oklahoma State, Texas Tech, Texas, Oklahoma, all these teams have been all over the board. Who of that group do you think will play the best football here in November?
I think Baylor's still the best team of that bunch. It's interesting to me how much the Big 12 backloads that schedule. This is not an accident. Oklahoma seems challenging, but it's in Waco, and Baylor's clearly a better team when they're playing at home in an untarped stadium, mind you.
Yeah, that's right.
Going to Oklahoma State, I think, is going to be the big challenge, especially with how well Oklahoma State is suddenly able to run the ball. And they play defense relatively well. The Oklahoma State schedule wasn't terrific early on in the season either. But Oklahoma State has the recipe. It's going to be a loud Stillwater. They're going to be able to defend the pass physically, you would think, somewhat. And if they're able to control the clock, if they're able to keep the Baylor offense off the field, I think they stand the best chance of being able to win in a variety of different ways, whether it's quickly, slowly, defensively, whatever the case may be. Do not buy TCU with how much they've struggled on offense, no matter who the quarterback is, even though it's on the road. And they do have the secondary and the physicality in the secondary to keep that relatively close, as is the formula against Baylor. Texas is worrisome just because they seem to be playing well enough at the moment. But it's in Waco, and at that point, you feel like if Baylor's undefeated, if they're 11-0, and they just have to beat the big, bad in-state school, that there'll be so much emotion and focus that you would think they'd be able to handle a Texas team that's still pretty good, but I don't think a team that anybody's really willing to fully invest greatness in at this point. So that Oklahoma State game November 23rd, maybe TCU the following week if Oklahoma State barely loses that game but really beats up on Baylor a little bit, TCU can make that ugly. But yeah, I think you got to circle the 23rd.
My head's going to explode if Mack Brown and Texas close Floyd Casey Stadium by ending Baylor's. I guess, especially if it's like Greg Robinson is the only defensive coordinator to shut down Baylor's out. And that's just going to be some weird college football cosmos thing. That's just us all getting laughed at by the college football gods, I guess.
That, I mean, that'd be unbelievable to go in, not even just to Floyd Casey, but to go into the Big 12 season and say, you know, we're still looking to win a Big 12 title after such lulls and disappointments against Ole Miss and BYU. And to have Mack Brown and that defense and that offense really become such a laughingstock early on in the season and turn it around. That's even I, somebody who revels in the comedy of Texas football, would have to say that's an impressive job, especially David Ash being out for as long as he's been out and is going to be out again this week. For a Case McCoy-led team to be successful in the Big 12 and win at Baylor, I would be floored and admit utter Big 12 defeat.
Before pivoting away from the Big 12, what do you think has been some of the key to Texas being able to turn this around? I'm not ready to buy in yet because I think a lot of it's just been their friendly early Big 12 schedule. Mm-hmm. But there are some noticeable improvements. Dajay Johnson's been healthy, and seems like a great running back.
Yep.
Case McCoy, like you said, not exactly a fantastic performance thus far this season at quarterback, but manageable. I mean, what are you looking at and seeing the biggest improvement for Texas?
It doesn't seem like they're turning the ball over nearly as much. It doesn't seem like they're not playing extraordinarily well. They've been limiting mistakes. They've been making plays that are within reason of their high talent level on both sides. They've decided to start. I think that the play calling on offense has been really good, where they've taken the ball out of Case McCoy's hands. They have 2 5-star really good running backs in Malcolm Brown and Jonathan Gray, in addition to sort of the more all-purpose guy and return guy in DeJay Johnson. I think it's DeJay and not Dajay.
I think you've got it right. That Texas games normally are on the third or fourth screen, and
right.
I've got no audio on those.
Oh yeah, that's a mute TV. No, that's completely. I've mispronounced so many names that people will write into the show and write into or just mention on Twitter, like, do you even watch these games? That's not how you say his name. Like, I can't have 5 games of audio blasting at the same time. I'm sorry. I just read these things and watch the games on mute.
Do they understand how hard it is to manage writing, Twitter, and watching? Like, there's already a lot of sensory overload going on, much less 5 different audio channels.
And not easy names, mind you.
Yeah.
I'm doing my best. I look in the media guides, but, you know, speaking off the top of my head, it's tough sometimes. But, yeah, I think it's relying on being more straightforward, being more basic, being more simple. There's no reason this Texas team needs to be complicated. Not crazy about the offensive line, but Jonathan Gray, Malcolm Brown, DeJay Johnson, they can make plays. You don't need 57 yards on every play. You know, Baylor is a very special example of wanting to score touchdowns on every play and kind of doing it. 10 yards is great. 7 yards is fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. Just keep doing that. And Texas has been, you know, the Oklahoma game was very nice. They turned over Blake Bell enough, but their schedule hasn't been the toughest around that. They, you know, they go to TCU and not a great performance, but they pull away with the crazy lightning storm. Kansas, Iowa State. So they have West Virginia this weekend, and it becomes a lot more interesting. They finished 2 out of 3 at home, I believe, with Oklahoma State and Texas Tech before going to Floyd Casey. So the Big 12, I don't know that they deserve more attention than the Pac-12 and the SEC, but if they can manage to have Baylor keep rising and stay undefeated going into middle, late November, if Texas stays undefeated within the conference, you start to build the anticipation for that matchup. If Oklahoma State plays really well until the Baylor game or through the Baylor game, as long as you have multiple teams in the top 12, 15, then I think the attention rightfully should shift back to the Big 12 as being a conference worth speaking of.
Speaking of conferences worth speaking of, there is there's a game this weekend that is gets a lot of attention. It'll be at 8 o'clock on Saturday night, and it's Notre Dame and Pittsburgh.
Yes.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm talking, of course, about LSU at Alabama, the latest iteration of Saban against Miles. This game lacking a little bit of the luster as LSU enters as a 2-loss team. The defense is not quite the John Chavis dominant defense of the last 2 to 3 years, but at the same time, there is the best offense that they've had recently. 2 great wide receivers, Zach Mettenberger. They seem to be able to challenge Alabama's secondary, which right now is about one of the only real question marks I've got now that the offensive line for Alabama seems to be congealing like a fine jello.
No, this is all true. Yeah, the game is interesting because, yeah, if the secondary is the question, and a lot of teams would like to have questions like Alabama's secondary, LSU does have the receivers that are large and physical, like the very, very specific weakness that Alabama had for Mike Evans, who is a weakness for everybody in playing a receiver that large and effective. So, no, neither Jarvis Landry or Odell Beckham are exactly that size because he's sort of like a defensive end playing wide receiver. But, yes, that it is a nice matchup for LSU's offense. You worry a little bit about Zach Mettenberger in the early turnovers, which spelled kind of disaster against Ole Miss. But LSU's built relatively well offensively. My real big concern with LSU is this is, you know, you look at the numbers, you look at their games, you look at their performances on defense, and it's a pretty average SEC defense this season. And it's weird that that finally happened, and I guess it makes a little bit of sense, but considering how well they've recruited the defensive side of the ball, it's a little bit of a surprise, but they lost so many juniors in this draft, especially in the front, that it seemed like we were buying the, like, well, John Chavis does it every year, but eventually that has to catch up, and I worry a little bit about them for four quarters against Kenyon Drake and TJ Yeldon and AJ McCarron. You know, if you give AJ McCarron a bunch of third and fours, he's going to grab 7 yards every time. It's not an ideal situation for LSU. So with the game in Alabama, with LSU's defense looking as, and even like Auburn's offense through the air was able to eat up LSU's defense at times, Nick Marshall, it's worrisome. And we've reached the point where it's kind of, you know, LSU loses to Georgia and Alabama just keeps on rolling in so many different ways where, you know, we say on the Solid Verbal, it's like Alabama minus anything. Like, there's nothing that stands out like, well, LSU has this crazy NFL defensive line, so Alabama's going to be limited. I can't point to anything specifically where I'm so confident in LSU to keep this close.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. All right, let's before we wrap on up, wanted to pitch this to you. What's one of the stories or one or a couple of the stories that you are looking forward to see unfold? And it's and I asked you, I don't know, in my email to let's avoid the who's number one talk because I really like to see some. I hate that that's always the first question on a radio hit, you know?
Right.
Three teams like, who's number one in the country? I don't know. They're all really awesome. I'm sorry. But you know, what are the stories you are interested in here as we go into the last month?
I'm always curious in November because I don't really like looking at bowl games the following year just because it's so arbitrary and there's so many different factors. But how teams finish a season, whether they can continue momentum that was unexpected, like a team like Auburn, whether or not, you know, the youth on the defense and that Ellis Johnson defense can keep performing at the level they have been, and the offense on the ground has been so good with Trey Mason. Teams like that continuing momentum, and teams that have sort of had setbacks or been a little bit disappointing, how they sort of finish the season, whether there's optimism and momentum going into the offseason with recruiting. Always curious about that. A team like Michigan State, curious about how they keep evolving on offense as they may have the best defense in college football.
Yeah.
They just may, and that's sort of strange and exhilarating all at the same time that Michigan State randomly has an awesome defense. Curious about the end of Texas A&M schedule with Missouri and LSU. Even though it doesn't appear that it will have a huge effect on any sort of national race, just Johnny Manziel staring down Death Valley, Johnny Manziel staring down Michael Sam from Missouri, that's still to me, even Johnny Manziel's having a better season probably than he did last year. So just the entertainment factor there. I'm a little disappointed we don't have small schools to really care about on any sort of real level. Like Fresno State is a nice story. I like watching Jordan Lynch at Northern Illinois, but I'm not sure what either of those stories mean on any sort of major level. Curious this weekend as a good underrated matchup in UCF and Houston, which should go a long way to decide and that sort of rejuvenance, not a word at all. rejuvenation of the Houston Cougars under Tony Levine. By the way, the lone Jewish head coach in college football.
Stand up.
So I like that. Curious about the Pac-12 South and how that all plays out. and how USC, if USC is able to keep getting the ball to Marquise Lee and Nelson Aguilar and their running backs, that becomes a lot more interesting to watch. And sort of the coaching situations around the country now, how that all sort of shapes out. And I'm trying to think, I want to watch everything, but of the teams that are not fighting for national attention, the Big Ten is surprisingly a little bit interesting with Wisconsin and Michigan State on the other side of Ohio State. Outside of that, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I was going to say, man, Michigan State, Ohio State could be an awesome Big Ten title. Like, my enthusiasm for the Big Ten title game went through the roof as Michigan State has sort of just come up from being I had Michigan State and Virginia Tech in the same little cup at one point this year, and then the cup spilled over and Michigan State grew and Virginia Tech fell off the table. I mean, I just feel like they both had such a good defense, and then the offense was just manageable, and now this is like, no, this has gone through the entire team. I mean, they are really playing a old school. I mean, they just grind it out. Defense gives Connor Cook just enough space so that he can sort of like keep getting the ball in his hands, find a rhythm. I mean, doesn't necessarily get out there and wow anybody, but man, he'll come up with a play every now and then. Jeremy Langford's pretty good running the ball. I got Michigan State and I got the Duke Blue Devils because I don't want to revel in anybody else's injury. But this past weekend, Michael Campanaro, Duke Johnson, and Bryn Renner all suffer season-ending injuries. Horrible, horrible news. All three, the best offensive player on an opponent for the Duke Blue Devils down the stretch. We might be talking about David Cutcliffe leading like a 9-3
That's unbelievable.
Team into the ACC championship game against Florida State. If they beat Miami, that'd be huge.
It was one of my favorite box scores, not just of this season, but of a number of seasons, that Duke-Virginia Tech box score, where it was both teams combined to be like 11.2% on third downs, and Duke didn't win with offense, even though, I mean, Duke's been playing their backup quarterback for some time, but they each quarterback throws four interceptions, and it's just an insane box score that shouldn't ever exist, but everybody's still like kind of happy because it meant that Duke was bowl eligible again. It was just a very confusing time to be a very distant ACC watcher.
It was the first of two things in FBS play in the 2013 season. First time a kicker has hit two field goals from over 50 yards, with that being Ross Martin. And the first time any FBS team had won a game this season without a single third down conversion.
That, I mean, it's incredible.
There is no belief in the truest sense of the word. It was incredible.
The fact that after that game, we could, with some accuracy, say, man, that Duke defense really locked them down, and have it be somewhat accurate.
Yeah, because they had their two Helton and the other linebacker's name escapes me right now, but I think they like each had a one of those turnovers. Logan Thomas was doing BOGO, buy one get one turnovers, and I think they both got in line and got some.
Yeah, Duke beat Virginia Tech with under 200 yards of total offense. And no third down conversions.
None.
That's, I mean, terrific. I love that.
Yeah. So those will certainly be interesting.
It's the most likable thing about Duke anything in the past decade.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was going forth with some back and forth with some Duke fans today as we're sort of piecing this all together. And I'm like, wait a second. So when was the last nationally ranked Duke team? Because now, I mean, if they're 9-3...
They're getting votes.
Yeah, they are right now.
I think they received one AP vote this week.
Ah, good for Joe Giglio or whoever that local writer is. All right, well, he is Dan Rubenstein, SB Nation, Solid Verbal. When is the easy call going to hit the interwebs this week?
This week it will be up tomorrow, Wednesday, midday Eastern time, as it normally does. But make sure you see it quickly because we talk about the two big Thursday night games. It's a good, if you like chicken nuggets,
I do.
Highly specialized, high-end chicken nuggets in New York. A place called Nugget Spot is where we go. A lot of sauce options. Do you have a go-to sauce for your tenders or nuggets?
I will explore anything in the honey mustard region. If someone is presenting a nice spin on honey mustard or another mustard type, I'll try it.
But you don't go creamy?
Nah, I've tried to ease off. I went really creamy, really hard for a while. I was like the heavy ranch, you know, to the point where you just it slows you down a little bit.
Sure.
But yeah, it had lots of good sauce options.
Lots of good sauce options. They had a wasabi mayo. You're doing pretty well when you add a wasabi factor. I mentioned on the episode, though, I'm thinking 2014. This is like my big thing right now. 2014, you heard it here first, the year of chimichurri sauce.
Chimichurri sauce.
That Argentine parsley, garlic, olive oil, just a very, it's sort of like Argentine pesto, I would say.
Well, the chimichurri, just the flavor in general is starting to catch on for sure.
Yes. So they didn't have that, but yes, there were all sorts of sauce options, high-end chicken nuggets. It's a fun episode.
It's always a fun episode. I do encourage all listeners to check it out. I told you it is very well done. Got my film nerd pants on, and I always enjoy that. But very, very cool. He is Dan Rubenstein. Make sure you follow him on Twitter @DanRubenstein. I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.